What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to Off the Chain, simply the best podcast in crypto. Let's kick this thing off.
Preston Van Loon is an Ethereum protocol developer and co-founder of Prismatic Labs. In this conversation, we discuss testing frameworks, working at Google, blockchain scalability, Ethereum 2.0, sharding, Ethereum Foundation grants, and what Preston and his team are building at Prismatic Labs. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I hope you do as well.
Anthony Pompliano is a partner at Morgan Creek Digital. All opinions expressed by Pomp or his guests on this podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Morgan Creek Digital or Morgan Creek Capital Management. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
All right, guys, bang, bang. I'm here with Preston. I feel like I'm going to learn a ton today because, frankly, he's got a bunch of experience in working on things that I don't really understand. So thank you so much for taking the time to come over from Brooklyn and do this conversation.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. All right, let's start with your background, kind of pre-crypto. What were you doing?
Sure. So let's start with university. So I went to Middle Tennessee State University. I originally went there for aerospace.
Okay.
And the whole time I've been, you know, interested in computers, like messing around, come from like playing a lot of video games, and like I went around my own server and had mods and stuff. So I got as far as I got my pilot's license, single engine pilot's license, and then I decided I wanted to switch over to computer science because it's just more interesting to me.
So some people would compare, like, you wanted to go to the moon aerospace and then, yeah, like crypto going to the moon as well, right?
Yeah, that might be it. You know, I just wanted to have a really big, like, positive impact on the world. And I think that I can maybe have a better chance doing that in computer science. So,
okay.
So I switched over, but I hate school. So I eventually dropped out. And then I just started working on, like, random stuff. So I was working on an e-commerce company. They were selling things on eBay and they needed to automate a lot of stuff. And then I hopped over to another company that was doing like some like financing in the trucking industry, and they had all their software in house. And then I was working on like a point of sale company. And then Google plucked me out of there and I moved to New York. So I worked at Google for a few years.
So you were doing all of pre-Google, you were in Tennessee still doing all this?
I was in Texas.
In Texas.
So I went from Tennessee to Texas. I'm from Texas. My family's all there. So I moved back home and just started working.
Got it. Yeah. Okay. And then you end up in New York working at Google.
That's right. Yeah.
And what was the draw to go to Google?
Google. So it's a really interesting company to work at. It's a lot of opportunity, a lot of things to do. And New York was a place where I'd always been like kind of interested in going there. I probably never would have moved here if it wasn't for Google though. But I thought Google has a lot of, they're solving a lot of hard problems, and that's interesting to me. And I'm drawn to that. I want to solve the hardest problem I can and hopefully make a big impact there.
Yep. And it feels like to me, you know, I worked at Facebook, you worked at Google. A lot of these companies, there's a natural draw to them because you kind of know that, hey, you're going to work on hard problems. Yeah. You're going to work on them at scale, right? And you're going to have a good chance of working with really smart people alongside you on those hard problems. And so it's kind of, you almost don't even need to know what you're going to work on yet, right? There's already an allure to those companies. And then once you get in, you can kind of figure out what you want to do. Is that accurate?
That is totally accurate. And the Google hiring process is that you're hired as a software engineer and you don't know, like at that point, you don't know what team you're going to be on, but you're just so pumped because anything you're going to land on is going to be amazing.
Yeah. It's funny. Facebook's product manager track is very similar. You know you're going to be a product manager, but you don't necessarily know what team you're going to work on. And then during the onboarding, you basically figure out what team you're going to be on.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool. All right. So what'd you work on at Google?
I worked in the ad space on a product called DoubleClick. It's recently renamed to Display Video 360. It's part of their advertising suite, but it's for more like ad agencies or like big ad companies. So it's bigger than, you know, AdWords is probably something that you and I might use because we have low spend. But if I want to spend $1 million on a campaign, I probably would want the support from system like this. So I was a software engineer on that platform, mostly doing on the advertiser side, doing web development for their web application mostly. And our team was pretty small, so we managed everything from deployments to our on-site reliability, keeping things online. So I kind of got a really well-rounded set of experience there because we were doing everything on our team.
Yeah, it is pretty funny how whether it's Facebook, Google, Amazon, you know, Twitter, et cetera, a lot of these companies, although they are large in number of employees, the individual teams are pretty small,
yeah.
Right? And they really don't use an incredible amount of resources to accomplish things. And, mm-hmm. and it feels like that's part of the magic sauce, if you will, right? Is even though you have the ability to work at scale, mm-hmm. you still might only have 10 or less people working on the project. Right. Yeah. And so you get the backing and the resources of this large organization, but the actual core team, yeah. it's like a startup almost, right?
Yeah. So DoubleClick is a pretty big product. There's probably 100 people working on it, but they divide it into smaller pieces. So each team, it maybe is eight or so people, and say, oh, you own the front end of the application or part of the front end. So that mm-hmm. was kind of what our team did.
Got it.
Yeah.
And like, it's pretty incredible to think of DoubleClick, which is probably, you know, billions of dollars a year going through it. 100 people is actually nothing compared to the, you know, tens of thousands that work at Google.
Yeah. I mean, they said, you know, keeps the lights on, right? Ads keep the lights on at Google. Yeah,
absolutely. Well, and it empowers everything else.
Yeah.
Right. All right, cool. And so one of the things that you've talked a lot about in the past that I find fascinating is this idea of just like testing, right? Yeah. And experimentation.
Right.
Maybe talk a little bit about kind of where your fascination or you know, focus on testing and experimentation comes from.
Yeah. So we'll start with the testing part is that when I'm building something, I don't trust that just like clicking the button that it does a thing, it's going to work. Like maybe it worked then, but if I don't have good testing infrastructure in place, I'm not assured that I'm going to break it later. So on our team, we really advocate and push for and require that everyone's writing really good tests. So that's starting with like the smallest level you can go, which are unit tests. So if I have something that multiplies two numbers, I'm going to write a suite of tests that says these inputs give me this output. And anytime someone new comes along, they're editing it, they're changing it up, if they accidentally break it, we'll know before they even check the code in. So that's super important. Going a step higher, we want to ensure that things in the actual system don't break. So doing like integration testing, which is to actually like stand up the whole cluster and run things and then check the in state or, you know, various checkpoints of the state and just see that, oh, it's still advancing. So in our case, when we're building a blockchain, we want to see that does rolling out this new release, will it sync with other peers or will it break entirely? So that's really important to me for testing because these kind of things, like you can't, especially once it goes to mainnet, you can't, it's really hard to do upgrades and to roll it out to the entire network. So you have to get it right the first time pretty much. So we're really, really big on providing this testing infrastructure and making sure that things are done right the first time before they're sent out there.
And so when you look at the testing piece, you know, one of the frameworks that I took from working at these large technology companies was this idea that first you have to design the correct test, right? The test has to actually be accurate. And what we mean by that is you're trying to solve a problem and there's multiple solutions. You come up with some sort of framework or test that you're going to put a hypothesis through. Yep. And then the second piece is you have to execute the test perfectly, right? And the idea is if you don't have perfect execution and the test doesn't work, you're then left wondering, well, was it because we executed poorly or was it because the test was invalid, right? But if you always execute perfectly, then you can very quickly tell either the test failed or it didn't because you never have to worry about that execution. Mm-hmm. How do you think about that in a world where you're talking about testing in kind of the code is continuously checked every time there's changes made?
Exactly right. And another thing to think about is what are you testing? So mm-hmm. if you're just testing like basically what the method says, I mean, that's great, but what you really want to test are behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
So behavior might be ensuring that a user can log in, not just like that their password has passed all these validity checks, but but really that it goes all the way through the system and that the behavior, we're testing behaviors and not just methods. So that's really important to me, and keeping it in continuous integration and automated. And that's another important thing, because when we're doing code reviews and things, the most annoying thing is to give feedback that, hey, I ran your tests and they fail. If we can automate that, a robot tells you it's faster feedback cycle, we can get things done faster.
Yeah, I forget the name of the company, but I recently saw, maybe like last 6 months, there was a company that basically creates some sort of technology that can identify all the potential vulnerabilities and basically tries to penetrate software, mm-hmm. right? Not just blockchain related, but just in general. And it's almost like this automated testing program can drastically reduce the number of vulnerabilities, you know, on day one. And then also it can help identify the most critical areas that the team should go back and try to shore up. Is that happening in the blockchain space as well, or is that more outside of blockchain right now?
I'm not too familiar with it inside of blockchain. I know that's really popular outside, like automated tooling for security testing is huge. Another thing for security testing is having the test like really help for audits, so they can actually see how the code is supposed to be used in this isolated scope. So they can look at this, look at the big picture, but the big picture might be 100,000 lines of code, and they don't have time to read all of it and to understand one method, they look at the test. So that's super important. In terms of like blockchain, I think things like smart contracts are kind of hard to test right now. But there are like frameworks coming out that do help you do that. And that's getting a lot more mature. So I'm pretty happy to see that.
Got it. And so let's switch gears to talk about Ethereum, right? Yeah. Obviously, you're quite bullish and think highly of the platform. Maybe just give us a kind of an understanding of, you know, how do you view it today? Where are we? What's going well? What's not going well? What do you think the challenges are?
Most
loaded question in the history of this podcast.
Right, I know. Yeah, that's a pretty loaded question. So I'm gonna go with my biased answer is that I want to talk about scalability. So Ethereum has had this great success where they've hit the peak of what the blockchain can do. So they've already like maxed out, if you want to call it, transactions per second being the scalable measurement of a blockchain. They did max that out already at the hype of 2017 and other points in time. So that's kind of a great problem to have. You have this blockchain that's so successful that it's really hit the capacity. So now we're wondering, okay, well, how do we take it to the next level? And so the research team, our team, Prismatic Labs, and a lot of other developers are building on it, Ethereum 2.0, which is just an entirely new rewrite of the whole ecosystem. So things that aren't going well are that the blockchain doesn't scale, and we know that. So if we're about to enter another run like we saw in 2017, where there's lots of excitement, we're getting lots of users on board, kind of getting closer to that global adoption that we're all striving for, we're going to hit this peak again where the blockchain starts to struggle. We're getting all the blocks are full of people, you know, paying high gas fees or waiting a long time for their transactions. So that's still a problem. It's the biggest problem in my mind. The second biggest problem is usability, UX, and just general like knowledge of how things work. So one great thing that the Ethereum community has been doing is they launched the new ethereum.org, which is a new redesign has some controversial feedback. Some people like it, some people don't, but the point is the content is better. It's hard to argue that this has more substance to it than it did before. So I think that's a huge improvement. And that it's on GitHub, so anybody can suggest changes,
yep,
or file a bug or whatever. So that's...
This was much more controversial than I think I understood,
right?
Like it's actually, people are... What are the detractors' point, right? The people who don't like it, what are they complaining about?
The look of it,
the
really.
Look. Okay.
Not anything else that I know. They just say, wow, this looks terrible, and they're just complaining. Some people have been helpful where they'll say, I hate this, and then they'll put their explicit feedback on the site, mm-hmm. and some people even submit pull requests, say, I hate this, this is what you need to do to fix it, and I've done it for you, just accept it. So So that's actually like way better, and it's a step in the right direction. So maybe they even claim that it's a work in progress. Like it's nobody said this is the final thing. So I'm super happy that they're doing it all, because the site before was from, I don't know, 2014, and no one's touched it since then. So big improvement, I think.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And so let's get to Prismatic Labs, right? And maybe talk a little bit about what you're actually building and why you're doing it.
Okay, so Prismatic Labs, we're a team, independent team of blockchain developers who are interested in scaling Ethereum. So what that means is we're developing an Ethereum 2.0 client. Ethereum 2.0 is the sharding and proof of stake rewrite of Ethereum. So everything is completely different. It's a huge undertaking. And
so what you're essentially doing, right, and you correct me if I'm wrong, because this is the part where you're going to do some teaching to me, is there's Ethereum, we'll call it Ethereum 1.0, which is this smart contract platform that has a lot of advantages. It had a lot of breakthroughs in terms of how people thought about using a blockchain and some of the applications it could have, but it runs into the scaling issue. Yeah. What you guys essentially are saying is, let's change to proof of stake and let's make some other improvements to the Ethereum model. Yeah. And you label that Ethereum 2.0, and that's what you're building.
Exactly. Okay. So it's a new blockchain that is fundamentally still Ethereum.
Okay.
But for some amount of time, there will be two chains running in parallel.
Okay.
They'll be connected. Ethereum 1 and 2 will have a one-way bridge, so you can migrate over early if you want to be a staker. If you're just ready to move over, that mechanism will be there. And then I think the eventual goal is that we'll break that separation, and then the Ethereum 1 chain will live on in some form, but the main Ethereum lives on as Ethereum 2.0 in this new proof of stake and sharded blockchain.
Got it. And so let's come back to proof of work versus proof of stake in a second, but explain what sharding is and why that's important.
Okay. So sharding in the traditional database model is we have basically one computer, right? And maybe this computer has 1 terabyte of disk, but once we start to fill up data on that disk, it's getting full. We only have one slot in our computer. We get another computer and then split the data between the two. So now we've effectively doubled our capacity. Now there's a little bit of overhead because these NAS computers have to talk to each other, but we think that it's so infrequent and the trade-off is worth it because we just doubled our capacity maybe for these small overhead of doing things. So
really it's just sharding's a big word for being able to break up large pieces of data into multiple parts, and you can put those multiple parts in a more efficient manner, right, in terms of storage of the data.
Yeah, so it's a horizontally scaling model. So instead of having like a better computer, we just added more computers. And that's what this is. Instead of having like a faster, better blockchain, we're just cloning the Ethereum 1 chain, and we'll have 1,000 chains which can talk to each other and split up. So we have 1,000 times more data storage, capacity throughput, because we can run things in parallel. So it's a big improvement.
Got it. And so in this sharding model where you're essentially just adding more blockchains kind of parallel to the initial one, you obviously get, or at least the theory, right, or even in practice, you're getting added capacity or performance.
Yeah.
What the people who disagree with a sharding approach, what is their complaint?
I guess the biggest complaint is that there's the additional overhead of these shards. So if what we're envisioning is that in order to take the most advantage of sharding is that you'll localize your application. So if you're a smart contract developer, you have 5 contracts that talk to each other, put them all on the same shard.
Got it.
Because that's where the optimization comes.
That's the most efficient place, the way to actually do this.
Yeah, but the argument is that given a random distribution of users, they're going to be randomly split over all the shards. They're going to be talking to each other, and it's not a real improvement. But we think that, you know, the behavior is going to be that people will localize, and that layer 2 will take advantage of handling the cross-sharding stuff. That's what I think is that. Yeah, there's going to be some overhead, but we can put some more of the work take some work off the chain and put it on layer 2 to facilitate these quick, you know, getting between shards if you need to do that, and keeping it infrequent.
Got it. Okay. So that's sharding.
Yes.
And then let's go back to proof of stake, proof of work.
Yep.
I think we've talked quite a bit on the podcast about proof of work.
Sure.
Explain what your view of the advantages of proof of stake, right? So rather than having the machines actually doing the validation, this proof of stake concept, what's the benefits there?
Right. So for the listeners to recall, the proof of work is the consensus model where miners will produce a block by guessing this random number that we know takes a long time, is difficult to do. So we can verify it quickly and know that they spent the work to do it. So it's proof of work. Proof of stake is a different model where you don't have to spend a lot of resources to do it in terms of computing. You put up some collateral to hold yourself accountable, right? And then you do your work where you're producing blocks or attesting to data to ensure that it's there and available and correct. And if the mechanism to keep people from acting maliciously is that if they're proposing blocks that have invalid state transitions, so maybe they're printing money for themselves or just making junk, trying to attack people or harm the system, well, you can enforce that within the base layer chain, the beacon chain, and actually penalize them by taking their deposit away and either burning it, or probably the person who was able to prove it gets some percentage of it, something to incentivize people to hold other people accountable. But the main benefit there is that you can do it on consumer hardware. You don't need to have a server farm with ASIC rigs and all this spinning tons of energy. You actually just need to be online and be listening for the data. And when your time comes, you just sign the correct thing and then broadcast it to the network. And it's really cheap in terms of computing.
Got it. And so the thought process here is that what you're building is essentially a proof of stake based sharding blockchain,
right?
Or, and the belief, if I understand this correctly, is Ethereum one, good idea, hit scalability issues.
Yeah.
By going proof of stake with sharding, you're actually able to still have the, you know, quote unquote Ethereum dream built, but in a scalable way.
Yep, that's right.
Okay.
Yep.
What do the, what I'll call hardcore Ethereum developers and that whole community, are they on board with this? Are they open to the idea? Do they hate you? I guess what's kind of your relationship with what I think of as like the you know, I'll call it the core developers without meaning anything other than just a name?
Sure. Yeah. I in general think people like what we're doing. I don't hear that people hate us. I'm sure someone out there thinks negatively of the
It's crypto.
The effort.
Somebody does for sure.
Someone's upset about it. But in general, at least in the Ethereum community, in our little bubble, everyone is super supportive. So that's actually like a really great question, because maybe something we can talk about is like, how are we funding this?
Yep.
So like Prismatic Labs doesn't have a revenue model. Like, we're building this open source client where anybody can use it for free, and we're not going to sell it to you. Like, it's open. You can download it and use it, whatever. And so we started this last year in January, and how it came about is that in December, I was on, you know, the chat rooms, like asking developers, like, hey, is anybody working on sharding? Because I see that Vitalik and others have like this paper written up and it's looking pretty complete. And, you know, why is nobody working on it? And then Raul Jordan was in the same rooms as me, basically asking the same questions within the same week or so. So we linked up on there, and he said, hey, you know, I'm actually going to be in New York City next week. Maybe we should have a coffee and talk about it. So we met up, we went over everything and said, like, okay, this seems like a good idea. Let's put a team together and just start building it, because no one's working on it. We're suffering from scaling. Let's do it. So we got a team of five or so people, put a name on it, Prismatic Labs. Raul actually thought of it on the way over to meet me. I didn't know that until like 6 months later. He's like, oh, by the way, that's when I thought of it. It was like I was walking from the train. So
I love that.
That was pretty cool. So we started working on it, started building, and then the Ethereum Foundation announced they wanted to give out grants for this like type of work. And we said, wow, you know, like the stars are aligning here. Let's apply for this grant and see what happens. And we actually ended up getting, in the first wave of grants, $100,000. So that was super cool. We didn't think that this was going to go even that far. We just wanted to work on this because it was interesting. No one else was doing it yet. And it was just like something we were passionate about.
Mm-hmm.
And then it started getting, you know, we just started working. We flew to Taiwan to hang out with the research team. And there was like an Ethereum 2.0 workshop for a couple of days. That was super awesome. We came back having to start over almost the work we'd done so far. And then in June of last year, there was another sort of Ethereum 2 workshop where we decided to take Casper, which was the proof of stake model that was going to go to Ethereum. And it was pretty close to being ready. We said, let's just merge these two ideas because some of the research for proof of stake can be reused. So we merged that and basically had to start over again. In between that time, we had received more grants from Aragon, which is a governance DAO framework. We got from District 0x, Spank Chain, WAN Chain, Ethereum Community Fund. And then in October, we got a big grant from the Ethereum Foundation again. And then we were working on things and we had, you know, some pretty good capital, but we were still all working our full-time jobs because it wasn't quite enough for us to, you know, leave Google and our other places we were working at. And so Vitalik does the YOLO grant, if you've seen on Twitter, where he just, the guy who never gives away Ether suddenly gives out 1,000 Ether at a time. So he gave us 1,000 Ether, which is super cool. He gave it to Chainsafe, another Ethereum 2 team. And yeah, so that was like super, super, super cool. So at that point we said, okay, you know, in January of 2019, we're going to go full, everyone's going to go full time and we're just going to heads down, build it. We have at least a year's worth of runway for five people. And we want to see this Ethereum 2.0 thing done. So we started doing it. And then today, this morning, we've launched our phase zero test network. So that's super exciting, huge milestone. It's taken us basically 2 months of debugging. Like it's been actually running for 2 months, but it just wasn't ready for the masses yet. But this morning it's out there, so it's super exciting.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, congratulations.
Thanks.
So it's exciting to be talking to you today when you get that out.
Yeah.
Maybe talk a little bit about for the last 2 months as you guys have been testing, like what some of the bugs are. Because I don't think a lot of people understand from the developer's perspective how hard this stuff is.
Yeah.
Right? Like it's not just like, hey, I woke up, I wrote some code and I ship it and, you know, hey, I changed the world. Like you spent 2 months debugging something that you built for months.
Yeah. Yeah, oh, we worked on it for a year and debugged it for 2 months. And part of the problem was that we have the specification, right, that we're all agreeing on. And that's like what the behavior that should happen.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a constantly moving target. So in the entire year that we were building this thing, that specification had been rewritten from the ground up 3 times. And then on the last, you know, iteration, it had been changing a lot. And it's still changing until June, the end of June, the end of Q2. That's when they're going to freeze it finally, and that's going to be phase zero. So a lot of bugs come around because when we've been updating to the changes in the specification, maybe we updated one part but forgot another, or there's an off by one error. So people are just not behaving correctly, and it's all like things that you can't just unit test. Like this is one of those things we test with the whole system. And another is like you have to test it at a scale. So one thing we found out yesterday is that our test network didn't work with more than 30 people. So
that's not good.
It's not good at all. And we wanted to launch it yesterday, and someone said, you know, hey, we should you know, just deploy a bunch of clients out in the cloud and see like what the traffic looks like. And it was just miserable. Like we had something where for every message that was received, it was going out twice.
Mm-hmm.
And this is like a exponential effect. So when you receive it, you give it to your peer who sends it to everybody, and you also do the same thing twice. So when you send it out, you're going to get it back twice from everybody else. So it was just one of those like oversights where, oh, when I'm running with my two computers in my house, it works fine. Or when I run on like with my friends or on the team, it's like working just fine. So I don't know, that was pretty crazy. Part of fixing that, we'd been running the chain for 1 week. We got to 1,000 slots, right? The slots are the new time interval for block times, right? It's a huge amount, 100,000 slots is a huge milestone for us. And when we were testing out some issues with syncing, we accidentally knocked all the nodes offline. So if this is the World War III disaster scenario, where if every node in the world went offline, you have nobody to talk to get the latest data. Mm-hmm. So we basically had killed the chain entirely. We couldn't get it back online, but we managed to recover one of the disks and then hacked one node together to say, just take the disk data and this is the latest data. It's sort of like a social consensus here, where like, we'll accept what this guy says because we have no choice. So we did that, revived the chain. It's still going. It's been going 8 days now. We were able to launch that test network, and hopefully we can get a lot of people trying it out today. Because we want to see a break, because yep. If it breaks now, that's amazing. Now we have a new bug we can fix, and that's going to like make it better when it finally goes to mainnet.
Yeah. Well, part of it is just like, if it's going to break, let's break it day eight, not in, yeah. you know, day 847 when there's yeah. billions of dollars on, right?
Yeah, exactly. So the timeline for this is that we're hoping to launch to mainnet at the end of the year. So okay. so maybe
you got like 7-8 months to continue on the testnet.
That's what I'm thinking. So the spec, as I just said, is that it will be frozen at the end of Q2, which means we in 2 quarters we can get everything. We're hoping we can get everything together where we're working. Different clients can talk to each other. So mm-hmm. our Prism client from Prismatic Labs, it only talks to other Prism clients right now, just for this first iteration. But that's not very useful because we want it to be multi-client. So that'll be a big hurdle. And then trying to get things to work on a really big scale. So running at 100 clients is great and all, but the system, I think the minimum amount to start is 16,000 validators. Mm-hmm. So we're going to need to run a test net with a lot more resources.
Mm-hmm. And that makes sense. Yeah. And then, so as you move forward, what are the challenges or things that you're worried about, right? Is it that
yeah.
it actually does break, or are there other things that you're worried about?
Yeah. I guess I'm not too worried, because I think we're in a pretty good spot. Things are coming along really nicely. There's a lot of work on the research side. There's in terms of the process between getting new ideas from someone's mind into paper so we can all work on it, the process and the review has been getting a lot better. I think that what we're missing is some velocity. I think we'd all like to go a little bit faster. On Prismatic Labs, we want to grow the team out to 10 or so people. So we're really hoping that in the next 6 months we can, you know, get more resources to mm-hmm. build out the client and also the support infrastructure to help like keep it healthy and alive and bugs, you know, out. So that's kind of in my mind, is just how are we gonna get there and how fast can we get there?
Got it. Yeah. That makes sense. And then walk me through the scenario. Let's say that you are successful, yeah. right? And you build this Ethereum 2.0, yeah. Proof of stake with sharding and it works, right? Uh-huh. And kind of Ethereum is ready to scale to the masses, if you will. Yeah. What happens to like the Ethereum 1.0 and kind of what yeah. are the ramifications of your success in that scenario?
Right. So the migration strategy. So in my mind, I think that the Ethereum 1.0 chain is not going to be very useful going forward.
Okay.
I don't think it's going to go away.
Okay.
Entirely. Some people might want to use it and might live on in some form, but I think the majority of people, I think that the dApp developers, the major applications are going to move to Ethereum 2. And
okay.
And
does that make Ethereum 1 like Ethereum Classic today, kind of where like it still exists, it's just not used by anybody really, or you know, am I thinking about that incorrectly?
It's a good analogy where okay. it will still live there, and as long as people are mining it and blocks are advancing, it's still a blockchain that you can interface with. So I don't know if it'll have any value. I can't really speculate on that, but the But that's what I think is going to happen. I don't think we're going to shut it down. Like, we obviously we can't, we have no power of that. The power is in the miners. If the miners are still mining, it still goes. We can't just say it's stop using it, right? So and that's the beauty of blockchain, right? We don't control it. It's awesome. So the strategy is that we maybe this is one idea anyway, is we take a snapshot of, let's say, a block 10 million. This is hypothetical. Block 10 million, we're going to snapshot what the Ethereum One chain looked like, break the connection between the two, and then spin up a new shard with that state data. So if you hadn't migrated already, you're just going to be copied over. Mm-hmm. In that sense. So that's the one way that it can come over and sort of transition from one to two.
Got it.
Yeah.
And when that migration happens, are there negative side effects to this? Like, is there anything that you foresee where you're like, look, we think that a negative, you know, aspect of this is A, and we're okay with that, but we do identify it? Or is there really none that pop out?
Some of the negative feedback that I've heard is that there will be two Ethereum tokens at one, or yeah, two Ethereum coins at the same time.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Because it's a one-way migration, there's not this backwards liquidity or whatever you want to call it. But I think that problem is solved in arbitrage, because if you really wanted to get your tokens back on that chain, somebody out there is going to be willing to do that for some small fee. Like maybe, let's say 2%. Like if I wanted to go to Ethereum 2.0 and I can get 2% more tokens by just trading with this person, then someone's going to want to do that. So
somebody will figure something out.
if there's an arbitrage opportunity, it's going to happen. I'm not too worried about it. The benefit here is that we keep the system simple. Having a one-way bridge is significantly simpler than a two-way bridge. So that's why we're doing it that way. But that's some of the feedback that I've heard, are people concerned that Ethereum 1 and Ethereum 2 are going to trade at completely different prices, which is a valid thought, but I don't think it's going to be that.
It's going to be weird if there's like ETH 1 and ETH 2 on exchanges, right?
Yeah, that's the other thing. So, yeah, I don't know. It's something to think about, and we're thinking about it, but I don't think it's going to be like dramatically different. Maybe just like a little bit.
Yeah. Well, and would it be fair, and again, I'm thinking about this out loud here, but I guess as long as the technology works and it gets to a scalable situation, the idea that there are different tokens on exchange, like all of that is almost on the periphery of the blockchain itself works and people can then build on the platform.
Right.
And so like, that's almost like it would appear to me, without thinking about it too much, that's the most important thing. Mm-hmm. Right. And then everything else is kind of second order effects of, if technology works, then we got a shot.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. We're not building this with like the trading part in mind. Like, that's an important part of the system. Like, if this has to have value for it to work, but we're designing something that's supposed to be scalable and trying to keep it simple, scalable, and usable. And then the rest will come with that.
I think that makes sense.
Yeah.
Before I wrap up, I usually go rapid fire questions. What do you think is the most important company in crypto?
Most important company in crypto. That's a hard question. That's first rapid fire one. I don't know. I think I'll go with Consensus on this, because they have just done a lot of work. They're trying, experimenting in all areas, having some success and failures, but overall, like, having a big impact in the community. So I really respect all the efforts they're doing. Everybody over there is doing a great job.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Okay. What's the one regulation that you would change or improve if you could? Anything that sticks out?
Yeah, I hear that it's hard for people to invest in stuff in the U.S. I think the regulation on like KYC, know your customer, and anti-money laundering laws are difficult. So, at least compared to the rest of the world, I would like to see that different. You know, because like this is not like, I'm not like buying into someone's crazy company. These are like small amounts and crypto that's going to have a big impact. So I'd like to see that to be more accessible to people, because the ultimate goal is global adoption. And if you have to have already $1 million in your pocket to get in, it's not going to benefit everybody, right? So,
got it.
Yeah.
What do you think your most controversial thought in crypto is? Like, what do you believe where you think a lot of other people disagree with you on?
I don't know. I try to stay away from those, so I don't know.
Well, it doesn't necessarily be a controversial thought in the sense of it is toxic, yeah. right? But just in the sense, like, is there something that you think will work that a lot of other people don't think will work? Or maybe you think that everyone's really bullish yeah. on something and you're not?
Most of my thoughts are on technical design, so... Mm-hmm. The group of people that disagree with me is kind of small just because it's a small sample set, right? But
yeah.
but in terms of like our interop architecture between the clients we're building, so the clients are two pieces. It's a beacon chain node, which is like the piece that handles proof of stake assignments mm-hmm. and managing everything. And then you have the validator client, which is actually doing the signing. And the way these talk to each other, the technologies we're using is... sort of controversial debate. Everybody wants to do it a different way. I'm pushing more for this schema-based framework called protocol buffers, but other people want to do JSON, which is like web technology, and it's not like that controversial. So maybe this is like a disappointing answer, but it's the best I got, you know?
If it's important, yeah, right? People disagree, it could be controversial.
Yeah, you know, I'm a pretty agreeable guy, so this is the best I can do here. Yeah.
That's all right.
Yeah.
What's the most important book you've ever read?
Ooh, that's a good question. So I read, I guess like in my career wise, I was doing a lot of JavaScript stuff mm-hmm. and there was a series called You Don't Know JS.
You don't know JS,
yeah,
okay.
or don't know JS, something like that. Yep. And it was huge for me because like a lot of people do JavaScript and they're like they know how to do like get buttons to do things and yep. things to animate and do this stuff, but like to actually understand like scoping and how things work on the internal layer, stuff they don't really teach you in school, especially me when dropping out. Like that was really huge for me. So it kind of opened the doorway for me to like get. It was like the first time I got interested in how things work under the hood. Mm-hmm. So I was like always interested in building things, but like how does it actually work? That's when I started getting really into it in terms of my computer science career.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I probably will not read it just yeah. because I feel like it'll go over my head too quickly, but it's fascinating to hear. Yeah. Not only is it an important book, you read it at the right time.
Right.
Yeah. Right. So the timing is almost as important as the information, mm-hmm. Which is pretty cool. Yeah. All right. So to finish up, Norman, I'll let you ask me one question, but first we talk about aliens.
aliens.
Believer, non-believer, think they're real?
I think they're real. It's hard in this vast universe to think that we're the only people out there that's intelligent species. So I'm going to believe they're aliens.
So yeah. I'm with you. I think that just from a probability standpoint, it's unlikely that we are the only species. And as many people on the podcast have said, it would be selfish of us to think that.
Yeah.
There is a group of people who are now trying... very hard to convince me that the aliens are already here, mm-hmm. right? And that maybe we just don't know where they are or all of that. So it's been fascinating to hear people's perspectives on how deep their alien beliefs go.
Yeah.
Right. What one question do you have for me to finish up?
Are you going to be an Ethereum 2.0 staker?
Ooh, interesting.
Are you going to validate it for us?
I don't know, is the short answer.
Sure.
I think that something... You know, my partners and I have, we start out with very kind of rigid thesis, uh-huh. right? Which is Bitcoin has a higher probability of being the global reserve currency than people give it credit for, right? So not necessarily even saying that it's a huge number, it's just, it's a higher percentage probability than people think, mm-hmm. right? So like that's one piece. Two is that a lot of what is happening right now is about automation and this idea that every stock, bond, currency, and commodity, so everything of value is going to be digital in the future, right? Yeah. Most likely cryptographically secure, most likely on a blockchain, all that, but doesn't necessarily have to be, right? So just can we use software to automate a lot of processes, et cetera? Obviously with the smart contract platform, that's a huge component of it. We cut our teeth mining.
Right.
So actually mining Bitcoin and Ethereum and going through, you know, the GPUs burning out, right, and dealing with ASICs and all stuff. So we've dabbled personally mm-hmm. in some of the staking stuff. We find it fascinating. I think that what I am personally looking for is where is it working at scale? Right. And so I think Ethereum 2 is a great opportunity for that to happen. So if the technology works and you see this, I don't see why we wouldn't be open to doing it, right? At the same time, part of this also is the idea of staking is very new to pretty much anyone in the financial world, right? This idea of like, hey, you're going to make an economic investment and then you are going to put that at risk in order to be part of running this net. Like, that's not a thing that they're used to thinking about. And so we've joked around about like, does that mean it's like the new fixed income type investment, or, you know, how do you basically describe it to our institutional investors that they're not technical, right? Frankly, they think of Bitcoin and then they think of blockchain, right? They don't even think of Ethereum and all this other stuff. So like, we're still kind of, you know, educating and kind of trying to chip away at this idea that there's other things other than just Bitcoin. And so I think that, you know, it's a thing where maybe at the end of this year, I can make this promise, you come back, we'll do this again. And then maybe we can, even if it's up and running, then maybe we'll stake some stuff kind of live and see how it goes.
Cool, that would be great.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah.
Look, it's pretty cool to kind of hear how this is going. And I think, you know, just our conversation today, there's aspects of this like Ethereum too that I think a lot of people don't understand. And then two, part of what to me is so personally intriguing about this is like the amount of support that you're getting from different stakeholders in the Ethereum community, right? It's not just you guys saying, hey, we're going to go do this. And like, I don't care if anybody likes it. You're actually having people who are saying, look, I'll provide resources, you know, financially, I want to be a part of this. I want to see this be successful. And I think that is, that's really unique and hopefully ends up, you know, accelerating your guys' success.
Yeah, it's huge. And one thing I forgot to mention is a lot of the contributors to our funding are actual just individuals. So we've had people $5 a month.
That's awesome.
It's been huge. Through Gitcoin, we've received, I don't know, $10,000 from the community. So that was super cool.
That is absolutely cool. And crypto is a wild place, right? You can never say never in crypto. And then I'm always blown away by just the generosity of people with their time, with their resources, et cetera. So it's cool to hear that you guys are benefiting from that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Awesome, man. Well, listen, I really appreciate you doing this. It's been very informative for me. Hopefully people listening got a lot of benefit out of this. And then end of the year, you come back and let's see where things are.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me.
All right. Thanks.
Hey everyone, Pop here. If you like this episode of Off the Chain and want to help us take crypto to the top of the Apple, Spotify, and other podcast charts, please do us a favor and rate, review, and subscribe. To review, simply go to the Off the Chain homepage, scroll down until you see the 5 blank stars. Taking 15 seconds to fill those stars in and leave a quick review goes a long way in helping us take the entire crypto ecosystem to the top of the charts. I appreciate you listening and see you next time on Off the Chain.